judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any form or manner of business before the Honorable the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit are admonished to draw a line and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. Please be seated. We're happy to hear argument in our first case, Kearns versus the United States.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Under Maryland law, an employer may be held responsible for the negligence of his employee who's driving an automobile if the employer expressly or impliedly consents to the use of that vehicle and the negligence occurs while the employee is carrying out the business of the employer. In this case, we have both of those circumstances. The facts support a finding by a fact finder, and we've argued in our briefs, actually, as a matter of law, the facts require the court to enter judgment in favor of the plaintiff. However, I'd like to focus our time here today in discussing why the facts gave rise to, at the very least, a dispute about whether this car, this vehicle, was authorized by the government and whether Ms. Scott, in driving the vehicle, was performing the business of the government at the time that she was driving it. And the evidence that was before the district court supported a finding in favor of the plaintiffs, but at the very least, again, it required that the judge submit the case to a fact finder because there were inferences that could be drawn
from. Well, the judge is the fact finder here, and if you submit it, it's going to be a trial of the bench.
Correct, but witnesses and cross-examination and credibility determinations, and it's not the same. Submitting paper to a judge to review and to determine, is this a legal question or is this a factual question? They're different. And having a trial on the merits with witnesses who physically come to the court and swear under oath and are able to be cross-examined is totally different than submitting paper. Yeah. Yes?
When we talk, it's usually good to stop because
yeah,
we like
I'm
to
sorry,
hear,
I did, I didn't
we
see
like
your
to hear ourselves.
You know? I'm sorry, I did not
no
see
problem.
You.
But we did have witnesses under oath, right? There are
That's
all kinds
correct.
Of depositions here.
There are depositions.
So you're suggesting that all the witnesses are going to change their testimony?
I'm not suggesting that they're going to change their testimony, but as Your Honor is aware, it's a different circumstance when you're taking a deposition than coming into court. I'm not saying they're going to change their testimony, but the questions that are posed to them by the lawyers may be different, and certainly the inferences and the way that the fact finder assesses their demeanor on the witness stand is different. In addition, we have paper documents in this case that are supportive of the allegations of both sides, and the inferences that can be drawn from those are different.
Can you give me a reason why Ms. Scott didn't seek reimbursement for the rental car?
She testified that she would have done so had this accident not happened.
But I would think that there'd be all the more reason to seek reimbursement because the accident did happen if she thought she was entitled to reimbursement.
Well, she does not expect I understand Your Honor's point, but I think another way of looking at it, and something certainly a fact finder could conclude, is that she felt bad. She got into an accident. Someone died. And to then go back and she wasn't thinking about a lawsuit. She wasn't thinking, I need to submit this so that I can prove that the government was responsible.
I'm not sure that we know that from the record.
We don't know one way or the other, but I think that's the point, that the fact finder could have drawn different inferences from that information and certainly could have concluded that she didn't submit for reimbursement because she felt bad that a man died in the car accident that she was responsible for. And I think that is
you
what
all
she
did. Sue her?
Yes.
And what happened to that part of the suit?
That suit has been stayed pending the outcome of this case. That certainly it could be inferred that she didn't.
So was that? Did you originally bring suit? I've forgotten. Did you originally bring suit in state court?
It
was removed?
In this case, yeah. I don't believe so. That might be a question for Mr. Beckman on rebuttal. I think this case has always been in federal court.
You didn't sue them in the same suit?
I don't believe so.
It's usual that you, anyway, it doesn't really matter, but I'm just surprised that you would file two different suits.
I believe that there are two different suits, but again, Mr. Beckman knows for sure the answer to that question, and he'll be speaking in rebuttal. What the district court did in this case was make factual determinations and draw inferences from the facts that could be drawn in, that taken in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, should have compelled her to reach the opposite conclusion. For example, she stated that there was no way a fact finder could determine that this rental car was authorized by the government, and the evidence simply did not support that determination, at least not as a matter of law. Ms. Scott had to get from BWI to the Radisson. She had to get there.
And her orders say rental car not authorized.
Her orders do say that.
And and you came up here once before and and had some theories about how there might be have been authorized, and we gave you discovery on it. It doesn't look like it checked out very well.
What the discovery?
I mean, it was supposed to be an email. What happened to that email that you said that?
The email orders are, I believe, in the record extra.
But you said it was an email. I thought you said it was an email that authorized her to take a rental car, contrary to the orders that had it written on there that you can't take a rental car.
I don't recall that, Your Honor. I don't recall.
And there was a theory conjured up during an argument that she might have been over at Fort Meade buying materials to take off to the meeting for her presentation.
I think that was my theory.
That didn't check out either, though.
That didn't. The evidence did not end up supporting that. But what we did learn in discovery, that's correct. What we did learn in discovery was that this practice of travel orders stating rental car is not authorized and then later subsequently being changed was routine. All three of the witnesses that testified acknowledged that despite travel orders that said rental car is not authorized, they were then amended either the morning of or even later on.
These were never amended.
They were never amended. She requested that they be amended.
Well, and I don't think the testimony is quite the way you characterized it. I think that there may have been universal agreement that you could amend orders. I don't think there was universal agreement that you could amend orders after the fact.
There may not be universal agreement, but that is precisely why this is a factual question that must be decided.
In any event, as Judge King's pointed out, her orders weren't amended after the fact.
She requested that they be amended, and that request was denied. That's correct. That testimony is for Mr. Cannon, her supervisor, who testified that she did request that they, and I believe it's in Ms. Wilson's deposition also, that she requested that they be amended and afterwards, and the request
was denied. I'm not sure how all that helps you. It seems to me that sort of puts the nail in that coffin.
Because, again, this is a case where an accident had already happened. So look, the people that were making that decision as to whether to amend or whether to reimburse were looking back at a woman who had already gotten into an accident. She testified, Mrs.
But this
Scott.
Money isn't coming out of, you mean, look at this in real world. This is their friend, this person they work with, and the person that would be paying the damages is the federal government, which we Americans seem to think has an endless amount of money to pay. So all of their human instincts would be to favor her, and yet they didn't.
I think that that's one way of looking at it. I think another way of looking at it.
They didn't give it to her, and there's a reason why they didn't give it to her that is it certainly doesn't support your case. But in any event, they didn't give it to her.
They didn't.
They didn't authorize it.
They didn't. But there is testimony and evidence in this case that had the accident not occurred, she would have been reimbursed. She would have submitted the request.
But from her?
From her and from her supervisors. Her supervisors testified that in the past, their orders had been amended.
One supervisor testified that.
And that is evidence.
But it wasn't, as I remember it, it was always consistent with carrying people back and forth to the airport, which she did not do. And that so therefore she wasn't within that exception.
Respectfully, I don't believe that the testimony establishes that on every single circumstance that someone took a rental car alone. First of all, there is testimony from all three of them that in the past they had taken a rental car alone and not used it to transport other people. That testimony is in all three depositions. There's also testimony that usually they shared them. But Ms. Scott herself described a circumstance where she was reimbursed for a rental car that she rented alone, and by happenstance, someone on the trip got sick and she drove them to the hospital. Well, that's not, we're sharing a car to conserve resources and pooled together. That's someone happened to get sick while we were on the trip, and I used the car to drive them to the hospital. So there's testimony from all three of them that they had done it in the past alone. It's on pages 125 and 126 of Mr. Wilson's deposition. I'm talking about when the travel orders. It's on page 225 of Mr. Cannon's deposition, page 344 of Ms. Scott's deposition, where they both testified that...
I thought there were all three. What about her real supervisor?
Mr. Cannon is her real supervisor.
No, he's an interim supervisor or a supervisor if her supervisor isn't there or something.
Ms. Wilson is 125 to 126, that she had been reimbursed in the past even where the orders did not authorize it. There's also testimony...
But your testimony was that they themselves had gotten this.
Yeah, Mr. Cannon said all three of them.
All three.
I misspoke. Mr. Cannon's testimony was that all three of them had done this in the past and others. So, to clarify. In addition, this is one critical fact that we haven't yet gotten to. Mr. Cannon testified on page 200 of the record extract, which is page 20 of his deposition, before we left, she, meaning Ms. Scott, was offered to either have a rental car or be listed as an additional driver.
And she turned it down, didn't she?
No, she accepted. She turned down being listed as an additional driver.
Right.
But she was offered to have a rental car before they left.
And she turned it down.
No, she accepted the offer to have her own rental car. She turned down being listed as an additional driver.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it says before...
You can make the argument if you want to, but I think you've got to read this everything in context. And if you want to argue that way, it's fine. But I think that you do better if you read the way it naturally goes. If you think that she got authorization by that testimony, if that's your position, that's fine.
I think that's what the testimony says. It says
okay.
Before we left, she was offered the choice to have a...
She was authorized to do it, and that's the position of these witnesses, that they authorized her to get a rental car in this case. That's what your submission to us is.
Yes, Your Honor. It says clearly, before we left, she was offered to either have a rental car.
And she turned it down. So she wasn't authorized. Authorized is a different word than offered, correct?
I agree with you that they are different words, but she was offered to have a rental car, and she did take a rental car. She declined the option to go with the rest of them and be a driver on another vehicle.
Okay.
The other point that we haven't yet gotten to is that Ms. Scott was in Maryland for the purpose of this three-day conference, and she had to get from BWI to Annapolis. The testimony is that as long as she used reasonable means, she could do what she wanted. And she was required to be there on that day for a conference that started bright and early the following day, and she lived in Pittsburgh. So this was a travel day. Everyone was coming at the same time. I don't think that everyone else who shared the rental car went to the hotel in the Radisson at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and stayed in their rooms for the rest of the day. She was in Maryland for 3 days furthering the business of the government. And
she rented that car, she didn't even go towards Annapolis.
Correct.
She turned around and went the other direction into Baltimore.
Without question. She did. And she went to Baltimore, and she went to
now
Fort Meade.
On a lark, I suppose, right? You have to admit that.
I think it depends. I think if the Court of Appeals of Maryland did not adopt the traveling employee exception to the workers' comp doctrine that we have discussed in our brief on certification.
Or if the workers' comp doctrine applied here.
If the Court of Appeals were to hold on certification that the traveling employee exception applies in vicarious liability cases, as other state courts have, then I think that she would be in the scope of her employment even on the lark. If not, she was on a lark in Baltimore.
She would have been in the scope of employment when she went the other direction to Baltimore, if they'd adopted that.
If
and you say she'd have been in the scope of her employment when she made a detour to go into Fort Meade.
If they adopted that, correct. If they didn't, I agree it was a lark. But the more important fact is that at the time this accident occurred, the lark was over. And she was undisputed.
Well, she was at Fort Meade.
But there's no dispute whatsoever that at the time of this accident, she was on her way back to
She was leaving Fort Meade and ran into your man on the motorcycle.
On her way back to Annapolis, correct. And I sort of wonder if she had gone directly from BWI to Annapolis without going to, I mean, I think that they're the same. She was traveling from point A to point B, and A was, wherever she was, going to Annapolis. It doesn't matter if
point C and point D and point E first.
With the understanding that the law is clear that once the lark is over and the employee resumes the course, they're back in the scope of their employment. And I think she was. And Mr. Beckman, as my time is about to expire, will address the certification issue in his rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, Larry Adams for the United States. As the court is aware, Ms. Scott was not authorized to rent this car to go from BWI to the Radisson Hotel. She had the option, and this is clear in the testimony from Barbara Wilson, the true supervisor, as well as Mr.
We have a problem with sound.
Am I not loud enough, Your Honor?
You're a little loud and you're a little soft.
Okay, usually I'm too loud, so let me
pull the microphone closer to you and you'll be fine. Right. Thank you.
She was not authorized to take this rental car from BWI to her hotel at the Radisson in Annapolis. The travel orders are, you can fly, but then we want you to take the shuttle, the super shuttle, and they even quote a price, the $58 price. Or you can take a taxi and we'll reimburse you. What the government is looking for here, what Ms. Wilson is looking for, is least expensive mode of transportation. And indeed, what Ms. Wilson indicates in her testimony is also a safety matter. She didn't want these people, particularly the volunteers who were going to be attending the meeting, to be by themselves. And this perhaps is a cautionary tale why that's a good policy. So Ms. Wilson is indicating some concern about the modes of transportation. After all, this Regional Readiness Command, the 99th, encompasses a number of states, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, West Virginia, D.C., and they are training on this long weekend of volunteers that are coming. And so they're trying to preserve the FISC, because the budget is not limitless, and they're also looking to the well-being of the participants. When this case was up here on appeal before, and Your Honors, Judge King and Judge Motz were on that panel, what counsel indicated in the penultimate paragraph of that opinion is, as Kern's lawyer explained at oral argument, however, discovery would show that at least for Rule 56 purposes, the government authorized Scott's rental car and Scott drove to Fort Meade for legitimate government business, and as such, purchasing supplies for the Annapolis conference where she was to present a briefing. Well, the evidence has gone just the opposite.
Well, they rely apparently on this statement, Mr. Cannon's statement in deposition. Before we left, she, the defendant, was offered to either have a rental car or be listed as an additional driver on either Barb Wilson's rental or my rental.
Right, and I believe that's Warrant Officer Cannon who was testifying, right, because ultimately they wanted to make sure those flying in from these desperate areas would have efficient and safe transportation.
Well, why doesn't that count as an authorization?
Well, it's an offer, certainly, but it's not authorized. As the court has indicated, she declined it. She told them, I want to do my own thing.
But isn't she entitled to think that that offer constitutes, offer, O-F-F-E-R, constitutes an authorization?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, for the reasons that you articulated, because she decided to do her own thing. She said she was going to do her own thing. The initial affidavit that she gave in 2009 said, it leaves you with the impression that she went from BWI to Fort Meade and then was about to go to Annapolis. We now know, as the discovery has pointed out, one, she went to Baltimore to sightsee, basically, for the afternoon after she arrived about 1:30. And then she decided that traffic was too heavy. Amazing, it would be too heavy on a Friday afternoon and a perfectly good day in June 2005. And she decided to go to the PX at Fort Meade, where she had authorization because her husband was active duty military, and she shopped there for a while. And then around 9 o'clock, she decides to leave and apparently gets somewhat lost in trying to make that left turn to look at the map. She does not yield the right of way, and she is negligent, and consequently, the motorcyclist, Dennis Kearns, hits her and is killed. So none of that was, the government didn't authorize any of that, and it didn't control any of that. If they had a control, they would have said, there's no reason to go to Fort Meade. Once you get to the airport, you should be going to the hotel to prepare for the briefing that you're giving the next day.
The other side would say to you, okay, it wasn't authorized. So if this had taken place on the way to Fort Meade, she's out of luck. But since she was going to the hotel where she was supposed to go, she was now acting in the course of her business or her.
As Judge Blake wrote, that is not. She was in a location where she was not authorized to be. Was not a direct route. She may have decided, if it's just a matter of turning in the right direction. I mean, Fort Meade is actually west-northwest of Annapolis. 97 is to the east of that. That's the route she should have been on to go to Annapolis, not on 175, basically, to go west to Fort Meade.
Does the case hinge on her taking the wrong road?
No, not really, but I'm just by point of emphasis of saying this was entirely her, we have the somewhat flippant word, frolic or lark, and this is a tragedy, obviously, for the Kearns family.
You say she had to take the most direct route?
Yes, I believe she did. I mean, the facts are.
And that's Route 97.
And that would have been Route 97.
So she got off Route 97, she was no longer within the.
Suppose she had taken Route 97.
Yeah.
Then what?
Well, then we would have had a different set of facts, and we'd have to examine it real closely, and it probably would have been a much closer case for the government. But when
because you accept that Maryland workers' compensation law applies here, is that
no?
Right?
I don't accept that at all. Workers' compensation applies here.
Yeah.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe
so. Principles developed there.
I mean,
are the only principles I can see by which would make you liable here.
And I would agree with that, and I don't think workers' compensation law applies.
But you just told me that if she'd taken the most direct route, then we'd have a different case, and you might be liable.
In that, perhaps I fell into, I didn't think clearly what the court was asking. No. We're really looking at vicarious liability under respondeat superior, and the Oaks case, the 1995 case, and the DeHarange case, the 1985 case out of Maryland, limited to situations that would preclude the employer, in this case the government, being liable for her for this accident, and she was not furthering the master's business at all. She wasn't authorized to have this rental car.
This is the argument that even if workers' compensation law applies, it doesn't benefit her. Is that the argument now?
Well, let me think that carefully through. I don't think this is a workers' compensation case.
I thought you were going down sort of the Maryland workers' compensation law and the elements.
Well, no, I'm going at the respondeat superior, other cases involving Maryland workers' compensation. I'm not going there at all.
What tells us that workers' compensation law doesn't apply?
Well, there is no, as Judge Blake wrote in her opinion, she rejected that argument. She considered it carefully, and I don't have the exact site in front of me.
No, I remember. Yeah,
that it simply is not applicable at this point.
Was this case first filed in state court?
No. I do understand that there was a case filed in Anne Arundel County, and looking at the docket sheet, I know that that's been stayed. So. We have only the federal case involving the government that was filed initially, and then it went back on for this discovery.
Are we to take it from your position here that the government will not, often in these cases, the government takes over the defense, substitutes itself in for the government actor?
Only if we find that the actor was within the scope of her employment.
And government's not taking that position here.
And Ms. Scott has never asked to be, as far as I'm aware.
She never asked for that.
Never asked to be scoped. It is plaintiff's counsel who's asking on behalf of the Kearns family to be scoped. And so in that regard.
Government's position is directly to the contrary.
Yes.
That she was not acting in the scope of
employment. And always has been.
And before I forget it, let me address the point about the reimbursement. She did apply for reimbursement for her taxi rides to the hotel after the event, and she was authorized to do that. She never applied for that rental car that was involved in the accident. So she had the opportunity. Now, one can infer just, you know, what Ms. Malarkey is saying, is that she didn't apply for it because she felt guilty about it. One can also infer, and perhaps more logically, that she knew she was outside of the scope and therefore didn't apply for it. So in that regard, I don't think workman's compensation law applies, and the government has never sought to scope her because we don't believe she was acting within the scope of her employment. So
if you're going to do that, somebody has to certify. Is that the
U.S. attorney would have to certify.
The U.S. attorney would have to certify she was in the scope of her employment.
That's correct, and the facts here don't allow for that. If in fact she presented that request, it would have to be approved by her supervisors. It would come up to
so
the
she's
U.S.
She's never requested that either.
She's never requested that.
And when you do that, the government comes in she goes out as a defendant. The defendant becomes the United States of America, and you defend it, and the government defends it and is liable under the Tort Claims Act.
That's correct, Your Honor. But that's never happened. It's not an issue. It's entirely the plaintiff in this case asking that she be included within the scope.
But there are other cases where the government refuses or is not asked to substitute itself in, and the government actor proceeds and the court orders the government in. Is that correct?
Yes, there is case law to that effect. But that, as I say, Ms. Scott, as far as we're focusing on her, has never come forward and said,
or if Judge Blake had tried the case on the merits and ruled that she was within the scope, then that would take, then the judgment would be against the government.
Right. But the plaintiffs have had two
but
shots.
She didn't try the case. She ruled against,
right,
ruled in your favor on summary judgment.
And Judge King, as you indicated, she's the ultimate trier of fact. There's no jury here. So she, a very experienced and accomplished judge like Judge Blake, understood exactly what she was doing in this particular case. I don't have anything else unless there's some more questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Beckman?
May it please the court. In response, Your Honor, to the question that was posed at the last argument, Your Honor gave me free rein and said, all right, Mr. Beckman, I'm going to give you free rein. Give me a fact or circumstance that would provide that Ms. Scott.
I think I came up with she might go get supplies.
And
so you might have adopted that.
Right.
But she didn't go get supplies.
She did not. But the fact of the matter is, Your Honor, that she had not completed her assignment, but she was on her way to the assignment at the time of the incident. I would direct the court to existing Maryland law, which we have cited in our brief, which is the Regal Laundry versus A.S. Abel case, which is the case of the Sun reporter who was covering the gubernatorial election that went down to Crisfield, spent the night in Salisbury, was on his way back to Baltimore when he was involved in an accident, and the court held that he was within the scope of his employment. That's precisely what we have here. Ms. Scott was on her way to this out-of-state assignment on the 24th. She could not check in before 4 o'clock in the afternoon. No question she spent time in Baltimore, but at the time of the incident, she was on her way to the Annapolis Hilton for the conference.
In the case, the person was returning from a job assignment. Ms. Scott wasn't returning from a job assignment. She was returning from her, let's call it a personal excursion.
Well, she was on her way, Your Honor, and I think it's undisputed, she was on her way to Annapolis and then got lost.
This is a distinction between, you held up, and you rightfully, because Regal case is the best case for you, this is different than Regal.
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that it is applicable here. But in any event, there is credible evidence here, which was not considered by Judge Blake, that it's on page 200, that Mrs. Scott was authorized to rent a car. Now, when you look at what the cost is.
You're changing that offered to authorized.
authorized.
On page 200.
I am, Your Honor, because it was offered to her. That is a response that says, you can do it. When a supervisor or a temporary supervisor says you can do it, you can do it. And Judge Blake made no reference to it. There are several instances which we've cited in our brief where that is in fact the case, where the judge made conclusions that we submit are of material facts that were in dispute. But in terms of the cost, if you look at the cost, because one of the factors that they looked to was, is it reasonable? Is it reasonable for cost? She pays $48, gets reimbursed $48 for her taxi from Annapolis to BWI. Well, if you double that, that's $96. The cost of the rental car estimated was $132. It is a $34 difference. And if it's close, then it's considered to be reasonable. And that was what the testimony was, is that if it's reasonable, you're going to get reimbursed. And Mrs. Scott has testified that every time she had sought reimbursement before, it was paid for a rental car, as were Ms. Wilson and Mr. Cannon. That is in the record. With regard to the issue of certification, our concern here is there is no definitive Court of Appeals case that says that the concepts of the traveler, the out-of-town traveler on a business trip, or the special mission exception to the going and coming rule, have been considered by the Court of Appeals in the context of a vicarious liability case such as this. In Durange, what the court said is, we need not reach that issue here. There is no case. And that is why, and because certification, and Your Honors are well familiar with the certification standard, it is a wide-ranging standard that is liberally construed where there is an issue that has not been decided by the highest court, which this has not. So if there is any doubt, and I would suggest that because this issue has not been looked at since that 1933 case of Regal Laundry versus A.S. Abel, that's 79 years since that's really been looked at, and there hasn't been another case. I think 79 years is enough time to take another look.
Thank you very much. We will come down and greet the lawyers and then go directly to our next case.